Good to see everyone. Yeah. Yeah, there you go. I have a little bit of cough or something, but I'm okay. Of course, being married to a nurse, the immediate thing is, do you have to go to the emergency room? No, I'm not. But, you know, if the Kaiser emergency room was kind of like, one of the exclusive areas when you take a long transatlantic flight. What do they call them? You know, in the airport, the waiting rooms that are really nice. Haven't any of you been on that, you know? Yeah, where they have all the snacks and easy chairs, and then New York Times is there. Then that would make sense. Yeah. So I'm waiting for that. I'm waiting for, like, the platinum card from Kaiser. Okay. The Buddha tried to describe the experience that he had not only under the Bodhi tree, but continuously. So sometimes he described, like, as nirvana. So the absence of hatred, the absence of delusion, absence of grasping. But also would sometimes describe it as liberation, right? Moksha. Then sometimes as mahasukha, great happiness. Mostly we describe it as, bodhi, awake. We also describe it as healing. Sometimes we describe it as the middle way. Sometimes we describe nature, realizing nature, mind. But I've noticed that over time, we make these fantasies about enlightenment. We make fantasies about realization. But a lot of us know what healing is. So at this temple, we've put a big emphasis on medicine Buddha practice and active bodhicitta and the chaplaincy work that we do. because we can understand healing, we can meet healers, we can, meet physicians and nurses and therapists and physician's assistants and nurse practitioners and acupuncturists and Tibetan doctors, all that. So we can meet these people and we have an idea of what they're doing. Like, they went to this school, they went to this medical school, they work at Kaiser. I always say kind of funny things about Kaiser, but I like Kaiser, so. Or UCD, or Sutter, or Dignity Health, something, we can actually meet them. And we have an idea of what it is to feel healed, particularly if we've been sick. So it's a powerful metaphor for, not just metaphor, but reality for our Dharma practice, to be healthy, to be healed, because we know what that feels like, and we can meet actually meet people that have been healed, even just physically, but also emotionally, spiritually, and we can see the education they've got. It's a little bit more difficult in this culture. Can you hear in the back okay? Yeah, so a little bit more difficult to know, like, okay, that person's awake or realized, or that person's a Buddha or not, because we're not sure, right? It's more difficult. it's not, we can look at their compassion, look at their speech and actions, but a little bit more difficult, particularly in a new country. I've also, in addition to Vajrayana practice, I've done a lot of Zen practice too, and when I was living in Nevada City, I used to go up to the Ring of Bone Zendo, which was under the direction of Eiken Roshi, a wonderful teacher, passed away a few years ago, and Gary Snyder, a famous poet. So my mother was visiting one time, and she liked to meet my teachers, see if they were nutty, you know. So we went to lunch with Roshi, and she said, "Well, which is great. I like my mom's style like this." She goes, "Well, how do we know you're enlightened?" And Roshi goes, "You don't." Just honest, right? And she says, "Well, how do you know if you're doing any good?" And he said, "Well, I'm giving it a good push." So to really know whether someone's really awake, we have to do the practice ourselves, right? We have to develop some of our own discernment. But it's a little bit more difficult. But it's difficult, too, in the healing professions. You know, sometimes people ask me, "Well, who's a good therapist?" And I say, "Well, you mean who do I like?" Or because you could be friends with therapists and they could be not so great, right? Who knows? So that's difficult, right? Unless you kind of sit in or... So sometimes in the past I'd say, "Well, here's the person I went to for therapy. So if you like me, you might like them." You know, things like that. Or in medicals, they sometimes said, "Would you send your mother to this physician?" Right? Like that. So even though healing is more easier to understand in some ways, we still have to check it out, right? We still have to do some of our own work and see if that person has follow through, to see if they're concerned, to see if their patients or clients, you know, get better, to see if they're good things. So we should look for good results. That makes sense, right? People should check out teachers and check out healers and nurses and physicians and physicians' assistants and nurse practitioners like that, and therapists, social workers, and chaplains. So one reason we're having the ceremony with Jada Rinpoche is that our chaplains are coming forward and they're going to take some vows and to get that ordination, get that blessing, so that we can see here's what they are saying they're doing, and here's what we expect of them. That's why we do these ceremonies. Probably most people have never, I'm always surprised, most people have never read probably the California Association of Marriage and Family Therapists Ethics. And I doubt if, has anybody here actually read through the HIPAA material that you get? Aaron, you did? Okay, all right. We got 2 hands. Yeah, that's good. Well, maybe you can explain it to me afterwards, you know. So explain HIPAA in 2 sentences, right? So the point I'm making, though, healing is closest. We have that understanding, but still we have to, you know, still check it out, right? Even though, you know, like that. So in our tradition, we're very interested in what people's training was and who they studied with and what they say they're doing. You know, that like that in our tradition. So actually, I kind of like it, like professionally sometimes. Every once in a while, I get someone from the East Coast, which is so different than I grew up, and people will say, East Coast a little bit, they'll say, "Where'd you go to school?" Anybody from the East Coast here? Do you know what I'm talking about? Yeah. Won't they say that? More often, they'll say that. In California, you never do. We don't care. If you look nice, it's okay. So they'll say, "Where'd you go to school?" And, you know, "What do you do?" And you know, "Let me look at your CV," and stuff like that. So that's fine to do that. That's fine to do that in Dharma, too. We should say, you know, what's your specialty? Who are you going to work with? What outcomes do you expect? What standards should we have you abide by, right? It's the same, you know, also in Dharma training, we should say, what monastery did you train with? Who teachers did you have? What practices did you do? What kind of experiences have you had? We need to do that, right? While at the same time, we need to do the practice ourselves so that we are a little better judge, right? So if you know something about, like, I'm just kind of a novice, but I know something about a little classical music. So I could hear, like, I could go to hear a concert and say, you know, that was a really incredible performance, something like that, because I just know a little bit. but on some things, I'd have no idea. So it is our responsibility, though, to do enough practice and gain enough realizations. So when we're, you know, saying what can you do, what's your results, where have you trained, then we have some idea, right? So we have to, that's part of the reason why we have the ceremonies, why we're doing a chaplaincy program, because people can see, okay, these folks went through this training and they went through this and they're saying they're going to do this and here's what they're going to do. That makes sense, right? Most people probably never ask, like, well, what's a lama supposed to do? Right? It's very nice. People are usually actually too trusting. Like, what should you be doing, right? So what kind of results? The reason we have these incredible teachers like Jada Rinpoche, Kenshin Rinpoche, Kangsha Rinpoche, so forth, is not just because of me, you know, because I have these credentials, but because we have results. So we're not Zen students where we're saying, don't worry about results, right? No, actually, we're results-oriented. We just don't want to grasp to them to improper results. So it's important that people come to the ceremony, you know, Saturday, November 10th, right? You know, so at 4 or 4:30, I'd come at 4. We have two different times, but... so that not only are you supporting people, but you're witnessing to it. So you can say, I was there, and you said you'd do this, and like that. That's important. You usually don't think that, you know. But in actual kind of Buddhist wedding ceremonies, when people take these wedding vows, then the people there should say, you know, by the way, you took this vow. That's the actual way, because usually there are no such thing traditionally as Buddhist weddings, except they turn into taking bodhisattva vows. So when the chaplains take their vows, and we also take our bodhisattva vows, those people that have taken refuge, then we each hold each other to the highest regard and also hold each other accountable. Then someone's realization and healing grows. So the point is that by knowing what we're doing, by having results, holding accountable, then actually that's how we know that we're free. We know that we're in nirvana. We know that we're awake. We know that we're seeing nature mind. We know that we're healed. It's very evidence-based. That makes sense, right, Penny? It has to. So we need to have a short discussion about that, because sometimes, you know, the Dharma practice and talking about realizing emptiness or realizing nirvana, then it seems very ephemeral. But actually, it's not. We benefit from using the healing, right? So... do we have bodhicitta? Do we have the desire for all beings to be free? Then we take these vows of what we're going to do and not do, and actually people can see. So one of my definitions of awakening, or the result of the path, is being transparent. So are we transparent? Can people see us? Or can we see them? Can we see us? So this is what I'm doing. This is who I am, and my actions and my words are totally out there. So that's one reason, big reason we do this ceremony, so we're out there. And then the chaplains are just kind of out there. But also as bodhisattvas, those people taking bodhisattva vows, we're saying, we're out there. It's kind of like sometimes you can go on to, you can go on to the Board of Behavioral Sciences website, you know, and you look up the practitioner and you see whether they have any, dings on their, any judgments or something. That's good, right? You know, we welcome that in Dharma, but we also welcome if there's been successes, we put that down too, right? We don't just say, well, I'm too humble to tell you about my results. No, we put that down. So we do say, just like we're going for a grant, like we had to do a grant for the Middleway Health Foundation to Tigert Foundation, still crossing fingers. So Michelle Livingston said, how many people have you served? And how many hours have you donated, blah, blah. But we'll probably get the grant because we've got a visit. But they said, well, she said, what outcome studies do you have? Yeah, we don't have any outcome studies. Here's the typical outcome study. It's like, well, they didn't come back, so they must be okay. Okay, that's, it's hard to do longitudinal outcome studies, because you can do one beginning and then end. And, do you really want to hear from a doctor, a therapist, 3 months from now, 6 months from now, a year from now? Let's just take a raise from you. Let's say from your doctor, a therapist, or a social worker, or Lama, you had to do longitudinal outcome studies. How many people would do it? Yeah, that's cool. But how many people would do it if you had like a negative outcome? Yeah. It's a little harder, yeah. How many people go to these continuing education credits and then you have to rate it at the end? They make you do, right? Yeah. In our tradition, it's okay to talk about outcomes. It's okay to say, I'm going to do this. It's okay as bodhisattvas, we say, I'm going to do this. I'm not going to do this. This is the kind of outcomes I want. And this is what's going on. So for me, just Lama Jinpa, so my outcome study, as far as like Sarah J and our lineage goes, it means you're the outcome study. You're the results of the outcome study, right? So the teachers come, they see beautiful temple, and students are asking really intelligent questions, and it's the energies awake and vibrant and kind, right? So that's the outcome study. That's good, right? So if you want to know, we say in our tradition, if you want to know the teacher, look at the students. Not just the teacher, right? What do you think, Elizabeth? Does that make sense? Yeah, it doesn't have to make sense because, sometimes they're bad students too, right? The Buddha had a lot of nutty people that he, had to make many rules and sometimes kick out of Sangha. But in each case, he dealt with it, right? So another part of outcome studies for Lama studies is, this sounds kind of nasty, but so the lineage folks, calling them that, sounds like central committee or something, but we're looking also at like, what people didn't work out, or what people were disciplined, or what people, had to do some remedial something, right? So like in therapy things, sometimes, I always turn to the disciplinary actions and see if I know the therapist, right? But sometimes they're kicked out or, surrendering license, but also sometimes they have to do remedial work. So when evaluating teachers and evaluating sanghas and bodhisattva work and healing work, you also have to say, well, what people didn't work out? we're always looking at that two sides in Dharma, like what works, what doesn't work, right? You know, what people didn't work out. Because usually we see that as kind of failure, like everybody should work out, but that's a mistake, right? So what people didn't work out, or what disciplinary action did the, you know, board take or Lama Chimpa take, that's important. We can have discussion about that. So I'm the only American, as far as I know, the only American Lama in Dalai Lama's tradition, and the only American Lama that's in the past fired Tibetan Lama. It's true. You know, so then my status went up a little bit. See. Because people know, like, oh, Lama Jinpa's not kidding about, you know, following the precepts. It doesn't matter who it is. Not kidding. You know, not kidding. Like that. Because if we let people in the hierarchy get away, then what's the message, right? So we always have to look at, you know, what people are we fostering and bringing about, but what didn't work out. Like if you say to a therapist, do all your people have a satisfactory experience, you know, they should say no. Actually, some people get worse. Is that possible? Can you see how that'd be possible? Like you get, you know, you start talking about your depression and you get into it and you go, well, it's worse, you know. That happens, right? Some people have a medical procedure, and it's because it's a medical practice, you know, some people get worse. That's hard to admit, right? But it's true. We have to tell that. So in the Buddhist time, actually some people got worse too, right? They did. They did the practice. It didn't work. They went crazy, had suicides in the Sangha, stuff like that, and it didn't work. So you always want to ask a teacher, well, can you give me examples of times when it didn't work? You know, like that, because it doesn't always work. So that's another way you determine if someone is having some realizations. If they say, you know, everyone does better, then that's, you know, of course we're talking in relative sense, maybe absolute sense everyone's fine, but relative sense not everybody gets better. So as bodhisattvas, as chaplains, particularly in the healing professions, one of the things that, might be in the ceremony, I don't know, I'll talk to Rinpoche, is like, are you willing to continue even, you know, when some people don't get better? Okay? Some people you work with, you may actually make worse. You know, you could make them worse, right? You know, you could make a mistake. It happens, right? You know, it happens. You just get bad advice or something, or somebody says, should I stay with so-and-so? And you go, yeah, I think, you know, maybe you should. And, you know, like, got kids, and, you know, usually I try not to give advice because it's a trap. But sometimes they say, well, what do you think? And then maybe you don't know about the domestic violence situation, right? So that person's injured. That sucks, right? But we have to admit that. Sometimes we say, well, I didn't know, you know, or something like that. So so one of the things and that chaplains need to be thinking about is like, okay, I'm going to be honest enough to come forth, you know, to get consult time or further things to go, well, gee, I went to see this person or I did this practice or then it didn't work. Or they jumped all over me. So there, I like to say there's people that want to be helped and can be helped. People know this. And then people that don't want to be helped but can be helped. And then I'm a little brain dead today, but eventually get to there's people that don't want to be helped and can't be helped. The thing is, you don't know that ahead of time. Do you? You don't. We don't. So So we as bodhisattvas just try to go, okay, we are literally doing our best, and then sometimes the patient dies anyway. Yeah. It's going to be a really wonderful ceremony. So we're doing bodhisattva vows, which are really important, which are, I would say, the same things about bodhisattvas, and then doing the chaplaincy thing. So we have to be able to tolerate and celebrate our successes, but also tolerate our failures. Well, no, this is the real thing, right? I'm talking about the real thing here. You know, I'm just kind of, you know, so anyway, we have, I'd like to hear from people. You must speak into the microphone. But some feedback or discussion, that would be helpful to me anyway. Patty has the microphone.
I want to follow up on what you were saying about being awake. Did I understand that if you have, you know, certain aspirations, and those aspirations are realized, fulfilled, then you're awake. But if they aren't, then you're not?
Yeah, or maybe still asleep.
Okay, so if you...
But they need to be actual aspirations. You see, usually we have deluded aspirations.
Yeah.
Deluded aspirations, yeah.
What's the difference?
That's a good question. That's a big one. What's a deluded aspiration? Yeah. Yeah. So, deluded aspirations, I want impossible things. Correct aspirations, I want possible things, yeah. It's possible to see who we are, see the nature of mind, see nature of phenomena. It's impossible to, predict who's going to win the lottery.
Isn't it also impossible to predict who's going to get better and who isn't? Who's going to?
Yes, it is impossible to predict because the karma is too difficult. Yes.
So then if you have an aspiration to help somebody but you don't, then you're a failure or what?
You're a conventional failure. You're not an ultimate failure. You're a conventional failure in that sense, you know, you could say in that sense. You know, so that treatment or that situation was kind of a failure. You could try again, you know, we're just telling the truth. You know, that didn't work. I wasn't helpful or whatever. That went weird or something didn't work out.
So, that's only from the practitioner side, from the bodhisattva side. Aren't there like two people at least involved? So why does only one person get responsibility?
Well, actually we both have, everybody has responsibility for themselves, you know, like that. But mental health, I'll just use it to be very specific here, is generally in healing, if things don't work out, we blame the patient. It's true. So so it needs to be somewhat even, perhaps. But generally, as bodhisattvas, we're taking a little bit more of the responsibility. We're taking a little bit more of the responsibility like that. That's a responsibility we have to hold. Other, you know, so we're kind of going, well, I'll try harder. So when I was working at Sutter Center of Psychiatry, you know, I'd go to treatment team meetings, and it always starts out with, of course, the physician and the psychiatrist and you know, give the report, and then, you know, you'd go down and you'll say this about this. This is what the patient's doing, blood pressure, participating in the groups, you know. So we'd be talking just about the patient, right? Then this is lovely. There was an older social worker there, Jerry, I say older, now my age, who said, "That's fine, but what are we doing for the patient?" Anybody who's been to a treatment team knows exactly what I'm saying. Because you're taking their inventory, but you're not saying, what are we doing? And if it's not working, is it our fault or is the patient's fault? Very few times people ask that question, they just go, non-compliant, AMA, against medical advice, right? So as bodhisattvas, particularly as chaplains, we go, well, that didn't work. You know, this maybe you didn't do the practice, but also I'd like to find out a way to be, you know, presented differently, right? Like that. So to be able to take that responsibility, you know, like to, we'd say in therapy, maybe own the transference, you know, like, okay, I'll take responsibility. The other person's responsibility too, but it's important in healing not to automatically, you know, blame the victim. We've seen too much of that, right? Haven't we? Haven't we just seen too much of blaming the victim? You know, like, why were you there at the party? You know, it's like, so, you know, we don't, as bodhisattvas, as healers, we don't want to drive it that way. Yeah, it's not a good idea probably to, you know, be injecting heroin, you know, in your ankle or the sole of your foot, you know, but still at the same time, we're going to say, you know, there's a better way to do that or not do it, or here's harm reduction or blah, 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 like that. Yeah. What do you think, Patty?
When do you know when you should, you know, stop what you're doing, like your efforts on your side, like to help? Like when do you, it just probably varies, I imagine. But how do you know?
When you give more than 49%.
Heard that one.
You heard that before. So that's the other thing, as bodhisattvas or chaplains, we really need to be aware of, you know. So if we're getting drained, it's our responsibility to know we're getting drained. You know, it's our responsibility to know that. What do you think?
Sometimes for myself, I don't realize that's happening.
Yeah.
Others around me.
Yeah. So we need a lot of good friends to say, you know, you look terrible, you should go home. You know, we need that. We need the support of the Sangha to say, you know, you look drained. Or we might look drained and we have plenty of energy. You know, that's possible too. Sometimes people that look really great are actually kind of drained. But we have to train to that balance. We have to train to knowing, you know, what our inner capacities are so we don't, you know, get overwhelmed.
Ramala, could you say a little bit more about the transparency part, like being awake and being transparent? Like, is it? Because sometimes transparency feels really uncomfortable.
Yeah, I know.
Like, often,
I hate it. Mm-hmm. Transparency means we all get angry. Isn't that so? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh. I mean, like that. It doesn't have to be confessional all the time, you know, like, you know, you're confessing. It just means here we are.
And when you're awake, you are fully accepting of that experience of, let's say, anger without projecting it onto someone else. Is it like that?
Well, I don't know if I'd always say accepting. You know, it's just like, you know, we'd say, yeah, okay, I was pissed. It doesn't mean it's always good, you know. I mean,
it just means not pretending that you didn't experience that.
Yeah. Unless it, I mean, sometimes it can be, you know, it's subtle. Sometimes it can be useful to pretend a little bit, you know, as bodhisattvas, sometimes we do need to kind of, you know, be skillful, right? So sometimes you have to be kind of skillful. Sometimes, you know, honestly, we have to appear to be angry and really not, or appear to be okay and really not, because the situation is very dynamic. But, you know, we're, you know, generally we're not lying to ourselves or others, you know, it's like that. That's a good question. I know, transparencies. Yeah, it's hard. So bodhisattvas are generally transparent. Shakya Treason, who's the head of head lama for the whole Shakya tradition. Some people have seen or done with Shakya Treason, who sometimes comes to the Bay Area. He's interesting. He's the Shakya group. Shakya lineage has monks, but also the head Shakya is from the Kohn family. So he's householder, and lots of times wears nice turquoise earrings. People seeing pictures. So some old friends of mine, a long time ago, you know. Their baby died. It was, you know, what, sudden infant death syndrome, something like that. Really distraught and wanted answers. So, you know, nobody was giving satisfying answers. So I said, why don't you go see? She was kind of not totally Buddhist, but kind of religiously oriented. And I said, Shakya Treason's in Kensington, so why don't you go see this Dalai Lama? Just basically like Dalai Lama. So, you know, I mean, who wouldn't be asking why, right? You know, when you put your child to sleep, they're fine. You wake up, go to the crib, and, you know, it's horrible, right? So she went to see, got an interview with Shakya Treason, which is hard to do. But anyway, so... she said, you know, why? You're an enlightened teacher. We know you're well-respected. And so what do you think he told her? He doesn't know. He just said, I don't know. I'm just a human being. Like that. Yeah. Just joined her in being a human being. We're human beings here. Right? Didn't try to, you know, just, I don't know. Probably she would have accepted, like, there's a reason and karma and da-da-da, but he's an incredible teacher. Just like our own Kenshin Rinpoche here, right? Just, like, transparent. Is that true? You know that, right? He just goes, well, and here's what I'm doing. That's amazing. This is a little sobering talk today, isn't it? No? Or, yeah, but it's important. We're taking bodhisattva vows. I probably won't get much more chance to talk, and then we're doing the chaplains, and it's a huge big deal.
Okay. I have a question about... how do you, as a chaplain or anybody else, how do you build resiliency, as in the ability to recover from failure, from loss, or how do you cultivate a deeper Dharma bowl? Or
I'm just talking spontaneously, but. You build resiliency by crying on the way home and talking to somebody else, right? Total nonsense is like, you know, I leave it at the office or, you know, like that. So we build resiliency by going along with our natural process of celebrating and grieving. You know, so when when something good happens, we should be jumping up and down, you know? And then when something goes wrong in chaplaincy, we talk about it or cry about it or, you know, critical incident, stress debriefing or something. What do you think?
I would hope that there's less crying and more celebrating.
Yeah, I do too, you know, but everything born is bound to die, you know, if we do hospice work and stuff like that. It's true, you know. We should be celebrating good death too, right? In a way. But I always want praise. I never want blame. I always want gain and not loss. You know, I always, you know, want, you know, to be recognized. That's what I like about Dzongkhar Khyentse Rinpoche, right? Susan, you've used his book, right? I don't know. Yeah, What Makes You Not a Buddhist, too. And one talk I was listening to, he said, yeah, I'm just totally into, of course, praise. I don't want to blame. Who does? You know, I'm just telling the truth, right? Just like, I'm out there. Yeah, but, you know, we have to, you know, particularly, you know, as chaplains, bodhisattvas grieve losses and talk to people afterwards and get support. There's nothing worse from my side than like, well, I'll just sit with it. Well, yeah, but, you know, that entails, you know, cowboy Buddha. You know, I'll just deal with it and I won't bother anybody and be very Presbyterian about the whole thing, you know. So that's generally not so good. You know, so what do you think?
I think it's sometimes hard to understand where to get the supports from.
Yeah.
Or it's not so easy to want to get supports. I just want to crawl into a rock too, which is not very healthy sometimes. So I think I'm concerned about taking on too much and not being able to be as helpful as I want to be. But then I also know that the more I've experienced with the veterans groups that I've been part of and such, I do believe there's a greater capacity to even look at the mourning and the grieving that needs to happen. And I can see my abilities, you know, to handle some of that stuff growing, but still there's just so much suffering in the world that it's hard to fathom that there can be enough support to take on all of that.
We need 1,000 arms, you know. So years ago, not so long, about 5 years, 6, you know, Rinpoche did 1,000 arm Chenrezig because regular Chenrezig, you know, thought she had saved everybody and then saw there was more, so head exploded. So then 11 heads and 1,000 arms, right, like that. But we can increase our carrying capacity, our reservoir of energy, but even when it's bigger, you're still only giving 49% of it. But we're increasing the size. So you can do that under practice. But, you know, if you just have a teacup, then you just can give 49% of that. But if you have a bathtub, then 49% of that, but it's a little bit more. Should we take like a short break and come back for, you think people will come back to meditate? What do you think, Eden? We'll come back, do short 18 minutes. Okay, let's, you can talk during the break. We made that rule. Or come up and say hi. We get 18 minutes now, right? Okay. No one else will say this, but I'm saying it like, if your mind's drifting to other things, just make it intentional. Okay? No, that's important. You know, I mean, if if you can fight a little bit, like, okay, go back to my breath or go back to my visualization. But, you know, sometimes it's better sometimes to turn into the skid. So you know, just kind of like, okay, I'm going to think about this and let that happen. Because, but make it then intentional. I'm going to experience the cause and the result. So I'm going to think about, you know, something, and then you're willing to experience the result when you make the intention, right? Because samsara is we want the cause, you know, we do the cause, but we don't want the result. Some of you may have already read the email Erica sent out. This Saturday, we won't be doing Geshe's down, seeing Rinpoche, and then won't be doing the afternoon workshop retreat. Maybe someone's at the door, do you think? No? You're looking. Brian's fearless. Is there someone at the door? Yeah? No? Yeah, they're doing skateboarding, right? Yeah. I ran into them like the other night. Like they come around. So they start sometimes around 10 o'clock. You know, so. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, they're nice. They go all the way down to the river and... you know, the little whiff of the herb. Anyway, so Saturday afternoon, Judy Taylor asked if she could have the temple for a service for her brother. You know, Judy's our board member and longtime board secretary. As people know, her brother died in a tragic accident about 10 days ago. So, she looked around for lots of different venues and said, oh, this would be perfect. So, yeah, of course, right? So we're going to make that available to her Saturday afternoon like that. I'm not totally sure. I think it's just family. I don't, you know, but I can check. No retreat. No, yeah. I'll ask, you know. She's been doing a lot, but she might, you know, whatever that looks like, or just kind of setting things up maybe, you know, kind of directing people. Here's the parking lot. You know, a few people coming from out of town. Don't think it's big, but it won't be big like Jan's, but like that. So I'm glad we can, you know, offer... you know, to do a service, yeah. Then announcement, so November 10th, Saturday afternoon, Rinpoche will be here, but also the whole weekend, Dr. Kalsang, our Tibetan doctor, and also licensed California acupuncturist will be here to Saturday and Sunday. So the whole weekend's kind of like big deal, healing retreat, and then the evening of Saturday, healing in the Kala Chakra Tantra. So It's amazing. It all worked out. Yeah, something will go wrong. It always happens. It's kind of a relief. You know, something will go wrong. Okay. All right, let's do a dedication. Merits of these virtuous actions. Attain the gate of a Guru Buddha. Perception, my state. Dual bodhicitta that has not arisen, arise and grow. May that which has arisen not diminish, but increase more and more. In the land encircled by snow mountains, you are the source of all happiness and good. All powerful Chenrezig Tenzin Gyatso, please remain until samsara ends. May the upholders of the teachings remain forever. May all migrators achieve happiness. May they fulfill all their temporary and ultimate goals. Teshvar, great treasure of objectless compassion. Manjushri, master of flawless wisdom. Rajapani, destroyer of the entire host of enormous. Tongkapa, crown jewel of the snowy land sages. Losang Drapa, I make request at your holy feet. Lala, so thank you, teachers and social workers, nurses, physicians, personal trainers, helpers, bodhisattvas, all of you, really appreciate it. Pardon me? Project managers, yeah, those are bodhisattvas, project managers, caterers, yeah. Bodhisattvas come, you know, if we're doing it with the bodhicitta, the vision of helping and liberating, then whatever we do, right? Yeah, so, okay. Okay. Yeah, that was good. Yeah. More shall be revealed.